Good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to welcome you all to Zollner Arts Center and Lehigh University. My name is Robert Flowers, and I'm the Herbert J. and Ann L. Siegel Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. I'm really thrilled that you can join us tonight for the Kenner Lecture on Cultural Understanding and an evening with former Representative Liz Cheney. This evening's lecture is made possible by Jeff Kenner, class of 1965 and 1966, along with his wife, Hyunja Laskin, and their support of Lehigh has been unwavering over the years. Though Hyunja cannot be with us tonight, it's wonderful to have Jeff with us. For 27 years, the Kenner Lecture has brought to campus speakers that often test our commonly held views and ask us to see things from new perspectives. The Kenner Lecture is the premier lecture in the College of Arts and Sciences, and past speakers have included Nobel laureates, prominent members of the media, and cultural and political leaders. We're delighted to add Representative Cheney to this list of distinguished speakers. Representative Cheney's visit to Lehigh comes at a critical time as our country prepares for the 2024 presidential election. She has been a steadfast advocate for the principles that underpin our system of governance and has consistently demonstrated a commitment to truth, accountability, and the preservation of democratic norms. Her memoir, Oath and Honor, presents a firsthand account of the January 6, 2021 insurrection and has spent more than 2 months on the New York Times bestseller list. Her insights challenge us to confront uncomfortable truths and inspire us to collectively work towards safeguarding the very essence of our democratic experiment. As we begin this lecture, let us remain open to the exchange of ideas and committed to the principles that bind us together as a community. One final note for the evening. At the conclusion of Representative Cheney's lecture, there will be a moderated question and answer session hosted by my colleague, Professor Marianne Madeira from the Department of International Relations. And with that, I wish you an enjoyable evening. Friends, again, welcome, and please join me in welcoming Representative Liz Cheney to Lehigh University.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you, Dean Flowers, for your kind remarks. It's wonderful to be here at Lehigh, and especially to be here as part of the Kenner Lecture Series to talk about democracy and the Constitution. And I do have to tell you, I learned something at dinner that made me like Lehigh even more. I have to admit, I didn't know that you had rescinded your honorary degree of Donald Trump, and I want to thank you for that. But these issues, as Dean Flowers said, of democracy and the Constitution could not be a more important topic or a more important time to have these discussions. For as long as I can remember, back to when I was a young girl, I've been involved in politics and in public policy discussions and debates. I volunteered for my very first campaign when I was 10 years old. It was 1976, and Gerry Ford, President Ford, was running for re-election. My dad was working for him. And my mom took my sister Mary and me to campaign headquarters to stuff envelopes. And my job specifically was to seal the envelopes. And so I was given a small plate and a big sponge that was very wet and told to run the envelopes across the sponge. I was really dedicated to this task and very determined and was working very hard at it. When the person who was overseeing the volunteers came over to supervise my work, and she pointed out that every single one of the envelopes that I had run across the sponge was so wet that it was not shut. And then she fired me. But I didn't let this discourage me from my determination to be involved in politics. And the following year, my dad was running for Congress in Wyoming, and President Ford came out to Wyoming to campaign for my dad, and he stayed with us in our house in Casper. It was a very big deal, as you can imagine, to have the former president staying with us, and I went to school the next morning. I woke up, and I walked out the back door of our house, and there was a line of kids, my schoolmates, from the back door across the backyard. And I said, what are you guys doing here? And they said, well, your sister Mary told us that if we wanted President Ford's autograph, we should line up here. It turned out that Mary also had been running a lucrative side business, actually charging for these autographs. I was impressed. I thought this showed a lot of hustle, but Lynn and Dick Cheney were not so impressed with Mary's ingenuity. And so the Secret Service sort of cleared out the yard. Everybody got their autograph. But those early years were really the start of campaigning very much as a family affair for all of us. If you fast forward to the 2000 election, as you will all recall, that was a very close election, one of the very closest in our nation's history. And my children then were old enough that a couple of them were on the campaign trail with us. On one of the very final days of that campaign, my daughter Kate, who was six, climbed up onto the airplane seat next to my dad. We had just finished, you know, probably four rallies in a day. And she said to my dad, Grandpa, if you guys win, will you come to school and be my show and tell? And my dad looked at her and he said, well, Katie, you only want me if we win? And she said, yeah. So even in the most intense campaign periods, the kids have always helped us keep our perspective. And that was a very intense campaign. It came down to, I think, 537 votes in the state of Florida. It was hard fought. It was emotional. But after it was over, Al Gore gave what I believe is one of the finest speeches in American political history. And I would urge you to go watch it if you haven't watched it in a while. In his speech, he quoted, as he conceded the race, he quoted what Douglas had said to Abraham Lincoln when he lost the presidency. Senator Stephen Douglas, this is Al Gore speaking, told Abraham Lincoln, partisan feeling must yield to patriotism. He said, I'm with you, Mr. President, and God bless you. And then Vice President Gore went on to say that the election had been, quote, resolved as it must be resolved through the honored institutions of our democracy. Our disappointment must be overcome by our love of country. And I remember a few weeks later, on January 20th, 2001, sitting on the inaugural platform on the west front of the Capitol as President Bush and my dad were sworn into office. And I remember very clearly thinking at that moment, what an incredible thing this was. What an incredible thing. And I know what it feels like to lose an election. And I know that Vice President Gore and his family and his supporters did not agree with the way that that election turned out. But what an amazing thing as Americans that we'd been through that, and yet we were all participating in the peaceful transfer of power. And it's such an amazing and fundamental underpinning for our democracy because of how powerful the office of the presidency is. There's another transfer that takes place at noon on Inauguration Day that really indicates and symbolizes the power of the office of the presidency. Every president and vice president, while they're in office, has with them 24 hours a day a military assistant. They rotate. There's a group of them. But at all times, the military aide for the president and the military aide for the vice president carries what's known as the nuclear football. And it's a briefcase that has within it the communications equipment and the codes that a president would need if, God forbid, he ever had to launch a nuclear strike. And at noon on Inauguration Day, When one president takes the oath of office and power transfers, that president's military aide hands that briefcase to the military aide for the incoming president. And it all happens peacefully. The transfer of power of the most powerful office in the world happens peacefully. Every single president of the United States, beginning with George Washington, every single president has upheld their fundamental oath of office to ensure that peaceful transfer of power until Donald Trump. And when Donald Trump woke up, when he woke up on January 6th of 2021, his intention, despite having lost the election, was that he would remain as president. Rather than concede defeat, Donald Trump decided that he would oversee a multi-part plan that was focused on corruptly pressuring state legislatures to change their votes from Biden to Trump, that was focused on corruptly pressuring the Department of Justice to help spread his stolen election lies. And of course, we know that he corruptly pressured his vice president to take illegal and unconstitutional action to overturn the election. He summoned a mob to Washington, D.C. with his lies about the election. And knowing that members of the mob were armed, knowing that they were angry, he sent them to march on the United States Capitol. And he did it because we were counting the electoral votes that would confirm that Joe Biden was going to be the president of the United States. He sent the armed mob to the Capitol to stop that constitutional function. And when he learned that his vice president was being evacuated because the mob was hunting him, he said, "So what? So what?" He watched the attack happen on television, and he refused for hours to tell the mob to go home. Now, the facts that we know about what Donald Trump was doing while the mob was attacking are not facts that we know from his political opponents. These are facts that we know from the people closest to him, from the people who worked just a few feet away from him in the West Wing, from people that he appointed to the most senior positions at the Justice Department, in the White House Counsel's office, from his own family. These are the people that testified to the January 6th committee and the people that have now testified in front of the grand jury. And we also know that in the middle of the attack, Donald Trump was handed a note. This we know from testimony to the Select Committee. He was handed a note, and the note said that a civilian had been shot at the entrance to the chamber of the U.S. House of Representatives. And when he received the note, he put it down on the table in front of him, and he looked up, and he continued to watch the attack on television. He would not tell the mob to stop. Now, I don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat or an independent. That's depravity, and we cannot become numb to what that means for this country. I would ask you, when you hear the news reports about Donald Trump's attempts to delay his criminal trial, to delay the January 6th trial, remember what he's trying to do. He knows who will testify against him in open court in that trial. He knows what those people have said to the grand jury. And when he tries to delay that trial, what he's doing is trying to suppress that evidence. Because he knows that if the American people see and hear the testimony of the vice president, of his acting attorney general, his acting deputy attorney general, his White House counsel, that when they hear from those people in open court, there's no defense for what he did. And as we all await the Supreme Court's ruling on his appeal on immunity, I hope that we'll all remember every single time he says this is election interference, that the real election interference is Donald Trump's effort to suppress that evidence and keep the American people from hearing it before we have to go vote. The other thing that we're watching, you know, I spent many years working overseas. I worked in Eastern Europe for the State Department, in Russia and Ukraine, across the Middle East. And I've studied history. And anybody who's studied history knows the tools and the tactics of an autocrat. And we're seeing Donald Trump use those tools and tactics now. Those include threats of attack and threats of violence. He's using words that he knows caused violence in the past. He's using words he knows were successful when he threatened members of Congress with violence, and now he's threatening members of the judiciary. He's also called for the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to be executed because he was doing his job. We know these tactics, and we know something else. We know that authoritarians, we know that autocrats cannot succeed alone. Donald Trump needs enablers, he needs collaborators, he needs appeasers, he needs people who will help him spread his propaganda, who will help him spread his lies. And he also needs good people to be silent. That's at the heart of the threats. He needs good people not to stand up and tell the truth. He needs people who know the truth and who know the danger to look the other way. One of the really terrifying lessons since January 6th has been just how many elected Republicans have been willing to make themselves hostages to this dangerous man. One of the things that I have heard often, I don't hear it so much anymore, but I heard it very often in the months after January 6th. And I heard this from members of the House and Senate, I heard it a lot from Mitch McConnell, was that we just should be quiet, that we should just ignore Donald Trump, because if we ignored him, he would go away. They said to me, if we all stop talking about him, he'll disappear from the public stage. Now, that was a very easy and convenient way for elected officials to rationalize not standing up, not doing their duty. And in my view, we are now seeing the fact that those elected officials who've remained silent have ignored Donald Trump all the way nearly to the Republican nomination for President of the United States. They've created a situation where not having voted to convict him in the Senate and attempting to act as though he wasn't a force that we had to defeat, he is now, in some polls, the leading candidate for President of the United States. And at the same time, members of Congress are threatening another January 6th. The Speaker of the House refuses to say, I mean, just think about this, refuses to say that Joe Biden won the election. And if you listen carefully, they will say, well, you know, Joe Biden is the president. But they won't say he won the election. The number four Republican in the House of Representatives refuses to say she'll do her duty and certify the next election. And it's very important as we get into this election cycle, as we get into the next 8 months, as we think about what's at stake in November, and as we think about what's at stake for our democracy, I ask you to focus on what these members of Congress are claiming. You know, Mike Johnson, who is now the Speaker of the House, was one of the leaders in the effort to overturn the 2020 election in the House. And if you go back and you listen to the argument that he made, it's a truly stunning argument. The point he made was that regardless of how the courts have ruled, regardless of the fact that the governors of each of these 50 states has certified the results of the election, regardless of the fact that election officials in each of the 50 states said that the claims that were being made were false, regardless of all of that, Mike Johnson said, quote, because I'm convinced that the Constitution was violated, I can reject these votes. That's his argument. That's not the rule of law. That's tyranny. Congress does not have that authority. Now, Pennsylvania, you know that you all were at the heart of many of these debates and battles. And Pennsylvania has sent to Washington many important and responsible members of the House in both parties. But you guys have also sent us some real doozies. And I'm not going to mention any names except maybe Mike Kelly and Scott Perry, but just – And I, because we're in Pennsylvania, I just have to tell you my Mike Kelly story. So before January 6th, we were having, well, this was actually after January 6th, after I had voted to impeach Donald Trump, in February of 2021, the House Republicans were having a meeting, a big meeting in a room a little bit smaller than this one, to debate whether I should be removed from leadership. This was the first effort that was unsuccessful to remove me from leadership. And so members were walking up to the microphones. I was on the stage overseeing the meeting. And members were going up to microphones. Some were expressing support for me. Others were not. And but Mike Kelly's line was probably the most memorable. He was very upset. And he seemed to be upset because I had issued a statement explaining my vote to impeach. And I was trying very hard to listen to what he was saying so I could try to understand exactly what his concern was. And he described it this way. He said, you know, when I saw that you voted to impeach, he said it was just like if you're playing the biggest game of your life and you look up and you see your girlfriend sitting in the opposing team's stands. Now, I was like trying to process all of that. And a number of my female colleagues started yelling, she's not your girlfriend. And I figured that was as good a response as any. So I said, yeah, I'm not your girlfriend. Like, you know, let's move on here. But the point is, aside from, you know, the sexism, the extent to which members were willing to take action that they knew to be unconstitutional, that they knew to be outside the bounds of congressional authority because they wanted to flip the election. And I will tell you that if you look at the states that the Republicans objected to in the last cycle, one thing becomes very clear. And a number of Republicans asked the question as we were having these debates. They said, wait a minute, to Mike Johnson, they're asking this question, and to the other objectors. They said, if your claim is Congress has the right to throw out the votes of millions of people and install the person that Congress wants as president, because you say the rules have been changed, which was not an accurate description of what had happened, and I'm happy to go through the legal arguments if you want to, but if you're going to make that claim that the rule changes necessitate throwing out votes, why are you only making that claim about states that Joe Biden won? Because the rules were changed in other states too. They were changed in states that Donald Trump won, and yet there was no objection to those states. Now, again, the rules changes were not unconstitutional. They were held by the courts to be legal, and yet these claims were being made. So I tell you all of this and ask you to think about what it means if the Republicans are in control of the House of Representatives in January of 2025. And I ask you to think very carefully about the damage that that could do, about the danger that that would pose. And I say that as someone who's been a Republican for my whole life. It doesn't give me any joy. It makes me very sad to say that, but that's where we are. Another claim that I hear sometimes is conservatives will say to me, Republicans will say to me, look, I understand and I agree with what you're saying about the danger that Donald Trump poses, but if he were to be elected again, our institutions would stop him. The Congress would be a check and a balance. The courts would be a check and a balance. Now, just think about what we're seeing today from the Congress of the United States, from the Republicans in Congress. It is very rare in American history to be in a situation where one man, one person, who's not the president, holds in his hands the power that Mike Johnson holds tonight, as we meet here tonight, the power that Mike Johnson holds over the lives and the deaths of Ukrainians, over the future of freedom in Europe, the future of freedom for all of us. Mike Johnson has the ability to put the bill the Senate passed to provide aid to Ukraine, Mike Johnson could put that bill on the floor tonight. It could be voted on tomorrow and on Joe Biden's desk by tomorrow night. And that's what he should do, and he knows it's what he should do, but he won't do it because Donald Trump told him not to do it. So if you hear people say, we can count on the Republicans in Congress to stand against a second Trump term, I would just tell you, they aren't doing it now. They won't stand up to Donald Trump now when he's not even the nominee. So we cannot responsibly count on them if he's elected to a second term. And that leaves the courts. And this may be the single most important thing to remember from tonight. When our courts issue rulings, they only have power if the chief executive will enforce them. The rulings of the courts only have power when the president enforces them. And Donald Trump won't do that. He's already said he won't do that. He's told us he won't do that. If he disagrees with the rulings of the courts, he will absolutely simply refuse to enforce them. And that is the quickest way for us to lose our republic. Now, we have already watched as the former president issues attack after attack at the justice system, at the judiciary. Think about the fact that in his trials in New York, in the E. Jean Carroll case, the jury has had to be anonymous. The judge in the E. Jean Carroll case instructed the jurors not to reveal the names of their other jurors, instructed the jurors, he advised them not to say that they themselves had served on the jury. And I ask you again to pause and think about what that means for us as a country. For the President of the United States, the former president, to pose such a threat that jurors who are doing their constitutional duty have to hide their identities from him is a very grave situation for us to be in. And sometimes I think the torrent of information and the torrent of threats that we get from Donald Trump make us very numb to what he's doing, to who he is, and we can't become numb to that. Now, the other thing that we know for sure that Donald Trump would do if he were to be elected again is ignore the need to confirm people. You know, people say, well, he wouldn't be able to appoint people who were irresponsible or erratic because the Senate would have to confirm his appointees, but they wouldn't. He will operate with acting individuals. And we know who those acting individuals would be. They would be people like Kash Patel. They would be people like General Mike Flynn. General Mike Flynn, in the days, in December of 2020, gave an interview in which he said Donald Trump should seize voting machines and deploy forces to rerun the election in swing states. And that's the kind of person, that's the specific individual Donald Trump has said he'll put into office if he's ever elected again. And I ask you to think about one other thing. The safety and the security of the United States of America depends upon many things, including intelligence cooperation with our allies. It depends upon alliances that we've built around the globe. Donald Trump says that he thinks that, he says that he's already told Vladimir Putin that he should feel free to attack our NATO allies. He's questioned whether or not the United States should stay in NATO. And if you think about the kind of intelligence sharing that we've had with critical allies over the years that's fundamental to our safety, imagine Donald Trump in office and the praise that we've heard him give to Vladimir Putin and to President Xi and to Kim Jong-un in North Korea. And imagine if you were an American ally, if you were the British, if you were the Canadians, if you were the Australians, if you were one of those countries that we have the closest relationships with, you would not feel safe about sharing intelligence with Donald Trump. And that development, in addition to everything else, would make us fundamentally less safe. Now, some have said, well, you know, what army would Donald Trump use to attempt to stay in office? And I point you back to what Mike Flynn said in December of 2020. General Flynn appeared in front of the Select Committee, and I asked him in his deposition if he believed in the peaceful transfer of power in the United States. And he took the fifth. And then I asked him if he thought that the attacks on the United States Capitol on January 6th were justified. And he said, he had his lawyer ask, well, do you mean morally justified or legally justified? And I said, I'd like an answer in both situations. And then he took the fifth. So that is what we're dealing with. That's what we're facing today. That's the nature of this threat. Now, my former colleagues, other elected Republicans, those who are enabling Donald Trump, they will be judged by history. And they will have to explain to their kids and their grandkids why they failed to do their duty. But we all have an immediate and a near-term and an urgent obligation and a responsibility. As we meet right here today, we have an obligation to do everything possible over the next 8 months to make sure that Donald Trump loses the election and that he's never again anywhere near the Oval Office. And I can tell you that that mission, that effort will take every single one of us, everyone in this room tonight. It will take every one of us across this great country. It will take every one of us committing ourselves to rising above partisanship, to voting for candidates that we believe in, to voting for candidates that we know will be responsible, that we know will do their duty. And this also means that we need more people becoming candidates. We need more of you to run for office. I mean, if you think about the complexity and the gravity and the seriousness of the challenges that we face globally, in addition to the challenges we're facing here at home, and then you think about the caliber of some of the people that we have sent to Washington, this is not a recipe for success. And if you're going to demand excellence, as we must demand excellence from our elected officials, that means we have to have excellent choices. We've got to have more people put their name on the ballot and run for office. And I want to say a particular word to the women in the audience tonight. I have, over the years that I've been involved in politics, I've had many people come to see me, candidates for office, come to see me for advice about running for office. And there have been a number of times when women have come to see me and they bring with them a list of all of the things they don't know how to do in a campaign. You know, they'll come to see me and say, I've never raised money before, or I've never given an interview on TV before, or I've never gone door to door. And I can tell you a couple of things. Number one, no man has ever come to see me with the list of things he doesn't know how to do. And number two, the men have no idea what they're doing. So, I ask you, the women in the audience tonight particularly, to please consider running for office. We need you. We really need you. You have a wonderful Lehigh alum who couldn't be with us tonight, but who's a dear friend of mine, Susan Wild. And Susan and I have our policy disagreements, certainly, but Susan and I became friends in the ladies' lounge. Which is a room that not many people know about, but it's a room off of Statuary Hall that used to be the office of the Speaker of the House, and now it's a room that's reserved for the women who are members of the House. And it's a wonderful tradition because it is truly a place where you make friendships and you build relationships, and you have the chance to talk about politics and other issues. And when you get to know people on a personal level, then it's much less likely that you're going to launch partisan attacks and engage in vitriol. And so two members who have connections to Lehigh. One is Susan, and the other is Charlie Dent, who also wonderful family connection here. And both of whom have had careers that demonstrate how important individuals are. If you look at what happened to us after the 2020 election, the only reason that our institutions held, the only reason they held was because of individuals. They don't hold themselves. They held because of the Capitol Police officers and the Metropolitan Police officers who stopped thousands more individuals from in the mob from attacking, invading the Capitol that day. They held because of brave elected officials across the country, people like Rusty Bauer and Brad Raffensperger, people who stood up to the pressure to violate their oath of office. And they held because of amazing young women, people like Cassidy Hutchinson and Sarah Matthews, who absolutely stood for truth when their bosses, men who were many years older than they were in some cases, wouldn't stand up and do the right thing, and they did. And it's because of those individuals that our institutions survived. So when you're thinking about what is going to be required of all of us over the next 8 months, I ask you to remember both the power and the obligation we have as individuals. And I tell you that I have absolutely no question that the vast majority of citizens of this great country want our kids to grow up and to live in a nation that is characterized by the peaceful transfer of power. And I also know that if we all commit ourselves that we're going to work together, that we're going to vote together, that we will be able to say that when this time of testing came, we stood up and we did our duty because we loved this country more. Thank you very much. God bless you all. Thank you.
Much for those remarks, Ms. Cheney, and thank you so much for being with us here tonight. I read your book, and I really recommend it. It was gripping all the way through, and it was really infuriating at a lot of points, and it was shocking at many points. But it was also truly inspiring and refreshing to read about your leadership along with those of your colleagues who served alongside you on the January 6th Select Committee. And your dogged pursuit of justice after January 6th, not to mention the months that led up to it. So your book's narrative begins on November 5th, 2020, 2 days after the election, when it was clear that Joe Biden had won. But clearly the problems that culminated in January 6th began a lot earlier. So I would love it if you could speak to us a little bit bigger picture about how you believe we got to the point where an American president tried to undo an election and was enabled in that effort by the leadership of the Republican Party and now has a significant chance of being reelected. How did we get here?
Well, that's a short question. I think there were a number of factors. You know, when I look back at the Trump presidency, And certainly we have this discussion of sort of, you know, at what point should you have seen the danger? And I know I can look back and say, obviously I wish he had never been president. That's clear. And there were certain moments throughout his presidency where he did things, said things that I knew were wrong and that I spoke out against. You know, when he stood next to Putin in Helsinki and said he trusted Putin more than he trusted our own intelligence services. So there were a number of instances like that. I do think that I certainly believed, and I think others believed, that you know, and this is partly from knowing how the White House works. I'd spent a number of years in and around the White House, and I believed that he would grow into the office. I believed that if, you know, you have a National Security Council, you have an executive secretariat, there are these structures in place that in the past, every other president has grown into the office, has understood and realized the gravity of these issues, and certainly that was not the case here. I think that if you look at sort of what was going on in 2020, he was saying, and we put some of this testimony on in the Select Committee, even before the election, you began to hear, looking back now, you know, people saying, well, Steve Bannon, Roger Stone, well, we're just going to say we won. No matter what happens, we're going to say we won. And I really thought, all right, the election happens. I assumed there would be some litigation, and he had the right to bring that if he had a basis for it. But I also think we all were sort of thinking, all right, as soon as this election is called, he's going to concede. And that's what Kevin McCarthy told me 2 days after the election when I went to see him. Kevin said, I've talked to him, and he's going through the stages of grief, which was like, for Donald Trump, involved tweeting in all caps. But Kevin said we needed to let him go through the stages of grief and that he would concede. But then, obviously, we started seeing things like the Rudy Giuliani press conferences and these wilder and wilder claims. And I put out a statement about the third week of November saying, you know, if the president has evidence to back up these claims, he has to present that evidence. But if he doesn't, he has to respect the sanctity of our election process. And obviously, that didn't happen, and it got worse from there. And I think certainly within the House Republicans, there was very clearly a sense of, you know, we're just going to do this one more thing for Trump. You know, we're just all going to sign on to this amicus brief. That's what my colleagues were saying. Or we're all going to agree to object to the electors. It was sort of like, we're just going to do one more thing, and then that'll be it. And that one more thing turned very dangerous very quickly.
And I'm sure you're sick of this question, but I have to ask you. So why did you vote for him, you know, not once, but the second time? Did you also sort of internalize that thinking of, well, I'm just going to do this one more thing for Trump and vote for him again in 2020?
No, I think that it, for me, it was a reflection partly of policies, and I was representing Wyoming, and many of his policies were the right ones for Wyoming, whether they were his policies or policies of his administration. And I think that, you know, if you look at it on a policy basis, now where he is today is not where he was then, but my support for him was really based very much on the extent to which he was cutting regulation, the extent to which his policies were helping the energy industry in Wyoming and our ag industry, the extent to which he had committed more money for defense, which I think is critical. But where we are today and where we have been, in my view, since January 6th, is not in a debate about policy anymore. Mm-hmm. We're in a debate about whether or not the country is going to go down a path where we elect somebody who has already attempted to overturn an election and to seize power. And that's the existential threat that we're facing.
Mm-hmm. And as part of your work on the January 6th committee, your committee recommended prosecution of Trump in relation to his role in January 6th. Those cases are obviously still working their way through the courts. So do you think that Trump should be disqualified from the ballot anyway? And do you see a clear legal basis for that?
Yeah, I think there are separate issues. So the effort that's underway in a number of states that's based on the 14th Amendment, Section 3, in my view, if you read the plain language of the Constitution, it's clear that someone who has previously taken the oath of office to the Constitution and participates in, or, and these words are important, gives aid or comfort to an insurrection should be disqualified from holding office. So I think it's absolutely clear that the plain language of the Constitution, Donald Trump's actions would disqualify him. Mm-hmm. Now, I think that, you know, we'll see what the Supreme Court does on this. There are a number of paths they could take. One that some people have been talking about is issuing a ruling that says the language of the 14th Amendment prohibits Trump from holding office, but it doesn't prohibit him from running for office. I mean, they could find a way to rule. We'll see what they do. I mean, my view on it is very clear. In terms of the criminal referrals, one of the statutes on which we referred him was providing aid and comfort to an insurrection. We also made referrals based on other sections of the code, 1512C, which is attempting to corruptly obstruct an official proceeding of Congress. His efforts to stop the electoral count, his involvement personally and directly in the fake elector scheme. You know, we know he was on conference calls with John Eastman, with the fake electors. You know, those very clearly, I think there's no question that you know, warrants prosecution, and he is in fact being prosecuted mm-hmm. for that. And so I think that the charges that he's facing, specifically the ones that I know the most about, are the ones that relate to January 6th. And I think if you read that indictment, it very much builds on the work of the Select Committee. And I think that, you know, our justice system can't be that in our justice system, a president of the United States can attempt to overturn an election and seize power, and we aren't able to hold that criminal trial until after the next election. That just cannot be the case. And so I can't imagine that the Supreme Court wants to be involved in Donald Trump's efforts to suppress that evidence and to delay that trial. And so I hope that they will rule quickly on this immunity issue.
Mm-hmm. Shifting away from Trump for a moment, though I know we all love talking about Trump year after year after year.
Are you guys clear on my view of that? 'Cause I'm happy to share more.
But shifting away from Trump, I would like to talk about the Republican Party for a little bit. Your book paints a really bleak picture of the Democratic prospects for the GOP. And you write that the GOP is becoming, quote, an anti-Constitution party. And we've observed significant Democratic backsliding in countries like Poland and Hungary and Turkey as illiberal right-wing parties have worked to subvert the rule of law in order to stay in power. So do you fear that the GOP would take the United States in the same illiberal, or some might say fascist, direction? And do you think that depends on whether Trump wins the election, or do you think they're headed in that direction even without him?
Well, I think certainly if Trump wins the election, you know, I began to touch on the ways that he could very, very quickly unravel the safeguards. And, you know, if you think about the damage that a few corrupt lawyers were able to do, you know, aiding him in his efforts after the last election, you know, imagine if you appoint a corrupt attorney as the head of the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department, or a corrupt attorney as the Attorney General. I mean, the threat that he poses is very real, and I think would be seen very quickly were he to be elected again. I think that the party itself, you know, defeating him is necessary but not sufficient, in my view. I think that what's happened to the party itself has been a real embrace of him, and in a sense, a cult of personality. Mm-hmm. And there have been so many instances where people really had to ask themselves, are you going to defend and support him, or are you going to support the Constitution? And sadly, they haven't chosen the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So I think we have a lot of work that we're going to have to do after this election. Whether the Republican Party can be rebuilt or whether we need a new party that's focused on conservative principles and values is not clear to me. Mm-hmm. But I think it's absolutely the case that it's in the best interest of the country if we have two strong parties where people can engage on substance and where you have to defend your policy perspective. Maybe you also have discussions with people who disagree with you, and maybe you change your mind sometimes. I mean, that would be a heck of a thing. But I think that's, you know, that's how a responsible, serious political party would operate, and that's what we have to get back to.
How do you think we do that? What's the path forward in terms of restoring trust in the GOP? And can you identify anyone who you think has the potential to lead a reinvention of either the GOP or a new conservative movement?
You know, I think that if, as we all have sort of, you know, lived through this period, I think that for people who have been paying attention, you know, we have all had a civics lesson, and we've all had a lesson in how our court system works and in the rule of law. And I also think that, you know, it's helped us to identify serious people. And so, you know, when I think about what it will take to rebuild, I think part of it is identifying those people on both sides of the aisle who are going to be trustworthy and responsible. And I think, look, it is going to take losing an election for another election. I mean, that's the other thing we didn't talk about, but the idea that the Republican Party would think that, you know, putting all of its hopes in Donald Trump to win elections when he loses election after election after election, yeah. You know, mm-hmm. at some point ought to be kind of, you know, a message that this isn't really the right person to put your hopes in. But so I think that it will take Republicans, and there are many more of them than are speaking out, Republicans who understand that we can't go down this path. And again, whether that's rebuilding the current party, changing the leadership completely, or starting a new party, I think that remains to be seen.
So it sounds like you think that if they don't make a break with Trump, that they are going to just implode and lose even more elections.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think we have to make sure that Trump loses in November. And when that happens, I think that it will be yet one more piece of evidence that the current mm-hmm. Republican Party isn't serving the purpose and the mm-hmm. function that we need it to serve.
So I'd also like to hear your thoughts on something even more important than the future of the Republican Party, and that's the future of American democracy, which is obviously your top concern. So we only have two major political parties. I think that's obvious. And how do you think a representative democracy can survive with only two parties if one of them doesn't recognize the legitimacy of our elections?
Well, I think that's exactly why we have to undertake such serious reform of the Republican Party. And mm-hmm. I don't think the problem is only having two parties. I think that, you know, we at this point are structured really to have two major political parties. It doesn't mean we don't have other parties, and it doesn't mean another party might not form. But I think the problem is what's happened inside one of the parties. And I think that, you know, if you think about sort of the future of American democracy is actually not just about America. It's also tied very much to what's happening around the world. And I think this is why what's happening in Ukraine is so important, for example. You know, if you look at the role that America has played in the world, particularly since the end of World War II, we have certainly had policy debates among presidents of different parties about exactly what, you know, what that role should be. But we have never had, since the end of World War II, the situation that we're in today, where you've got so many members of one of our parties who are advocating isolationism and who seem not to have understood the histories, the lessons of the past. And so I think, again, this is why we need to be in a place where we can have these debates and these discussions and understand that, you know, that words matter. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I've come to see and come to understand is that if we're engaging in our politics by vilifying our opponents, you know, if you disagree with somebody and so the response is to say that that person is a threat to the Constitution, then when you come across someone who really is a threat to the Constitution, I think voters tend to say, well, we've heard these attacks before. And so I think that we all have to think very carefully about how we engage with our opponents. You know, when I was working on the Select Committee, there were many times when I would be sitting in a meeting with Speaker Pelosi and thinking, I really hope that she hasn't read my Twitter feed from a couple years ago. But what it tells you, sort of the magnitude of the moment, because when she was thinking about appointing me to the committee, and I learned this later on, a member of her staff who didn't want me on the committee, who thought it was a bad idea, went to Speaker Pelosi with a document that was entitled, "The Top 10 Worst Things Liz Cheney Has Ever Said About Nancy Pelosi," and gave that to the speaker. And to her great credit, the speaker took one look at it and she handed it back to the person and she said, "Why are you bothering me with things that don't matter?" And I think she understood what I understood, which was like our policy debates are irrelevant when we have a 5-alarm fire about the Constitution. And another colleague on the Select Committee said to me many times, this is Jamie Raskin, he said, "I really look forward to the days when you and I can disagree again." And it's a really good point, because that will mean that our democracy has righted itself and that we're back to debating issues and not dealing with the threats that we are today.
Mm-hmm. That anecdote about your Twitter regret, which you're not alone in, by the way, it is a good segue to something I wanted to ask you about your career. I'm curious as to whether there are instances during your time in Congress when you wish you would have acted differently or worked differently to achieve your goals.
I wouldn't say acted differently, but there are certainly times that I look back now and I wish I hadn't been so partisan. Mm-hmm. And there's a tendency in Congress, and it's especially if you're in the leadership of one of the parties, where you get in this mode of, if you're a Republican, you know, let's say the Democrats are in the majority, the Democrats will introduce legislation, and there's sort of a reflexive instinct, and it works the other way too, a reflexive instinct on the part of the Republicans to immediately attack it, to immediately say, here's the talking points, here's everything that's wrong, to launch into this partisan battle. And I think that it's pretty clear that that doesn't serve the country. Now, that doesn't mean... It doesn't mean that we won't have debates. We have to have debates, and we should, and that's how you get to the best policy for the country. But I do think realizing how much words matter and how responsible we all need to be for that vitriol. You know, and I think there are a lot of reasons why Congress is as partisan as it is. I really believe one of them is because people's families don't move to Washington. And when my dad was in Congress, and I was 11 or 12, we moved, the whole family went to Washington during the school year. And when the families are there, and the families socialize, and you meet each other at the soccer field, and you know, you get to know people as people, then, you know, it's much harder to sort of launch constant attacks. Mm-hmm. Now, again, I mean, look, I don't think that you can say it certainly isn't the case that in the past we haven't been partisan. There's a wonderful exhibit at the Lincoln Presidential Library in Springfield that is, you walk through this hallway and it's holograms of people, you know, and they're 19th century people, and as you walk through, they're yelling at you. And they're yelling things that people wrote to Abraham Lincoln when he was the president. And they're terrible things. And it's a very effective display at helping you realize we shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that everybody got along. Certainly, we've had horrific times like the Civil War, but, you know, even in modern history, there have always been partisan, intense politics. But I think that we need to be able to, first of all, differentiate between what's happening now, the promotion of violence, the promotion by one party, the inciting of violence. That's something that's new in modern times, and certainly new when the source of that incitement is the former president.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think we have time for a couple more questions. One that I think, you know, relates to your call to us tonight to do everything we can in the next several months to ensure that Trump loses the election. In your experience, talking with voters or, you know, maybe other people in your personal life, what do you think has been the most effective in changing the minds of Trump supporters?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is to realize that there are some people that you're never going to change their minds, mm-hmm. and we don't have to change everybody's mind. I think recognizing that there's a core of people who will vote for Donald Trump no matter what. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also important for us as we go forward beyond this election to remember that that there are millions of people who believe what he's saying, who are good and honorable and honest people, and they've been lied to by him and they've been betrayed by him. And we have to keep that in mind as we think about what does our country and what do our politics look like in the future. But there are more people who do not believe the lies, more people who understand the danger. You know, right now we're sort of inundated with news about what the Republican electorate looks like because we're living through the primary season. And I think it's important to remember that those stories about what the Republican electorate is doing right now aren't reflective of the general electorate population. But there are also some real warning signs for Trump in these numbers that we're seeing in the early primaries. When you have between 30 and 40% of Republicans saying they won't vote for him, that is not a winning recipe for him going into a general. Mm-hmm. And I think that the key for us in terms of, by us, I mean people who believe in the Constitution, the key for us is to make sure people understand that no matter how frustrated you might be with Joe Biden's policies, and I certainly disagree with many of them, and I'm not endorsing anybody tonight, but we can survive bad policies. We can't survive a president who goes to war with the Constitution. And that's the choice for us.
One last question. So I'm a political scientist, so I am very concerned with impressing upon my students the importance of high-quality political institutions for ensuring representative outcomes. So I would love to hear from you. You know, among the institutional reforms that are occasionally discussed in the national conversation, campaign finance reform, congressional term limits, ending gerrymandering, eliminating the Electoral College, among other things. Based on your time in Washington, what is one institutional reform that you believe would most strengthen the quality of American democracy and that you would encourage today's students to fight for?
I think there are a couple of them. And I think one is looking at different ways to run our primary process, looking at things like multi-party primaries, ranked choice voting, so that you don't end up in a situation where both parties' primaries generate the most extreme candidates, And then our districts are drawn in a way that, that there's no opposition in the general. I also think that, and I've changed my mind on this next one, I think we really have to look at term limits. And and I think, I do think there you know, are constitutional issues with that that we need to sort through. But and I have been opposed to term limits previously because the way that Washington works, if you insist on members of Congress only serving a few terms, then you very quickly end up in a situation where the people in Washington who have the most power aren't elected. And that's a problem. But given what I saw among my own colleagues after January 6th, it's very clear that the incentive structure for people to do the right thing may require that they not be worried about whether they're going to get reelected again. And it's a really sad statement, but I think we have to look at that.
Well, we're out of time, and I want to thank you, Ms. Cheney, for being here with us tonight and sharing your thoughts, but also for standing up so courageously for our country and for
thank
our democracy.
Thank you.
I know it was tremendously costly for you professionally, and I'm sure personally as well. And I really admire and respect your leadership on that. So
well,
thank you very
thank
much.
You.
And I'm sure I'm not
here.
Alone. I know I'm not
thank
alone.
You. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And I want to thank you, the audience, for being here.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you all. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was a real pleasure. Please exit safely. Thank you for attending the Kenner Lecture, and we will see you here next year. Thank you very much.